From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Adolf Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany on January 30th, 1933. 70 years later, it is still difficult for the world to grasp how the man who led his country into World War II and orchestrated the mass killing of 6 million Jews, gays, gypsies, and communists was allowed to come to power, and in a democratic country. Some historians have called the rise to power of Hitler's Nazi party dumb luck. Others see it as a logical outgrowth of political currents sweeping Germany after its defeat in World War I. But Germany was not the first democracy to face times of upheaval, fear, and anger, nor will it be the last, which makes Adolf Hitler's ascent to power an endlessly fascinating tragedy, especially in times of turmoil. Tonight on Point, Inside the Rise of Adolf Hitler. But first, CBS launched a television miniseries on Hitler last night, recreating scenes from the rise of the man and of the Nazi party. Joining me now from New York is Ron Rosenbaum, a columnist for the New York Observer and author of Explaining Hitler, The Search for the Origins of Evil. In a recent article in The Observer entitled Sweeps Time for Hitler, The Drama Behind the Docudrama, he describes some of the controversy surrounding the CBS docudrama on Hitler. Good evening and welcome, Ron Rosenbaum.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Ron, I want to get into the controversy that you described in your piece, but before we do that, many people may not even know the origins of this miniseries. CBS bought this from another company. Can you describe, just in a nutshell, where did this come from?
Yes, it was initially supposed to be based on Ian Kershaw's excellent biography of Hitler, actually the first volume that undertook the span from his birth in 1889 to 1936.
So the origins and rise, not so much the war period.
Exactly. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing that, but Kershaw and the company that was making the miniseries parted ways last year. And part of it had to do, I believe, with the way they wanted to fictionalize history, you know, and in a docudrama form, you're making up dialogue for Hitler, that sort of thing. I'm not sure exactly why Kershaw was off the project, but a new script was brought in. The first script was described by someone who had read it as one emphasizing how poor, sensitive Adolf was, you know, sort of in some way giving him an excuse for his crimes, and two, that by ending in 1934, one person who had read the script said it was a triumphalist kind of Hitler miniseries. It made Hitler, someone say, look like Rocky at the
end. You didn't see all the blood and woe that followed, but it ended up in the hands of Alliance Atlantis, a Canadian production company working or creating it for CBS.
Yes, and here's where the really interesting controversy begins. Alliance Atlantis, as you said, is a Canadian company, and the executive in charge of this project spoke out to TV Guide.
And, this is Ed Gernon, executive producer.
Yes, exactly, and he sort of boasted that what he had really done in this movie was make an analogy between the fear that gave rise to Hitler and the fear that allowed Americans, cowardly Americans, to accept the policies of George Bush. I think what he actually said was they will stand by Americans and let it happen because of fear of what would happen if they don't. And he compared Americans' fear and acquiescence to preemptive strike, that sort of thing.
And he said this to TV Guide, and before it even hit the newsstands, Ed Gernon was gone. Is that right?
Yeah. I think that, you know, the question is, was Gernon saying that Bush was as evil as Hitler? I think you have to be a little cautious in making Hitler analogies, you know, because someone once said, called it arguendum ad Hitlerum, can often be a dead end.
But he wasn't the only one. The director of the film was also drawing these parallels.
Also said, this is exactly what I'm trying to show. And then what was really amazing, okay, first, I think the comparison Bush-Hitler is sort of staggeringly inappropriate and calling Americans cowards. But then the Canadian company that was calling Americans cowards or saying that's what this was about fired Ed Gernon for speaking out. I mean, they have a line at the end of tomorrow night's segment in which a brave journalist says, you know, never, I must urge you with my dying breath, you know, never fear to speak out and say the unpopular thing. And then they fired their own executive for speaking out.
They said something they didn't like. And there's one more, what you call a scandal in the middle of this, Ron, which is a kind of twisting of quotes in the middle of this Hitler CBS miniseries. Let's listen to just a little bit of where history may be turned a bit to try and make the parallel you describe. Let's listen.
Herr Reich President, surely you can see I'm a force to be reckoned with. The sooner you appoint me Chancellor, approve my cabinet...
I will never appoint you Chancellor. How dare you presume, sir? You're nothing but a Bohemian corporal. If I made you head of this government, how would I answer to God?
And how will you answer to Germany if you don't?
But this completely overrides the Constitution. Effectively, it puts you in charge.
These are troubled times, sir. The Constitution could not anticipate them. The National Monument has been destroyed. Our democracy is under attack. If we're to wage war on these foreign infiltrators, certain civil rights must be suspended.
And there is, from Hitler, The Rise of Evil on CBS, this is from tomorrow night's portion, Robert Carlyle playing Hitler in an exchange with the German president, Paul von Hindenburg, played by Peter O'Toole. And Ron Rosenbaum, you point out that the comments, the whole perspective is being turned here to try and make it fit, to your mind, an American circumstance.
Well, you know, the really egregious distortion of history comes a little before that.
And I'm going to say they're talking here about the burning of the Reichstag, which of course
the burning of the Reichstag, when Hitler says the communists did that and then we must crush them with an iron fist. That's the standard account of what Hitler said. However, in the miniseries, they say the terrorists did this and we must crush them, or Hitler says the terrorists. And I think that change from communists to terrorists is fascinating, because I think it's this is the Alliance Atlantis attempt to make the analogy between the rise of Hitler and the age of Bush. And, you know, you're free to make that analogy if you sincerely buy it, that it's proportionate, et cetera, I guess. But I feel there's something wrong with changing Hitler's words to make that point. I mean, they do this in the first moments of Sunday night's episode. They have Hitler's father dying of a heart attack in front of him, when in fact that never happened. I mean, he died, at his tavern or whatever.
Ron Rosenbaum, you've written so probingly about Adolf Hitler. Clearly, you also see that there's still material, there's still understanding to be gleaned from looking back at what happened with this man. You spent a lot of time doing it yourself. Do you think that this particular miniseries shares any of that valuable understanding?
Well, you know, I'm conflicted about it, because I believe that it's a natural human impulse to want to understand this phenomena. And so I don't oppose the impulse. I sort of feel there's something wrong with twisting history to make a point, and I'm not sure how much more we learn about Hitler from this miniseries or his origins. I mean, they throw in just about every possible theory, the abuse excuse, Hitler feared he looked Jewish, you know.
A little touch of everything is in there.
Yeah, and you know, the problem is that, one reason we can't understand the Hitler phenomenon is, as Yehuda Bauer, who was one of the leading Holocaust historians, told me, you know, there's just a lack of evidence, particularly in the early years. I mean, and conflicting evidence and gaps in the record. And, you know, there are just, Hitler is not like some mystery necessarily theoretically beyond understanding, but as Yehuda Bauer said, that in some ways he may be practically beyond explaining fully, because we just don't have all the evidence that we need.
Some gaps in the record, but Ron Rosenbaum, you have filled in the picture substantially for us tonight on the background, very interesting background of the CBS miniseries. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ron Rosenbaum is a columnist for the New York Observer and author of Explaining Hitler, the Search for the Origins of Evil. We're talking tonight about Adolf Hitler, 70 years after his rise to power in democratic Germany. How could a democracy, any democracy, put this man in power? Does Hitler's rise speak to a weakness in Germany or in democracy more generally? And what lessons can, should we take from Hitler's rise? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Eflin, North Carolina, is Gerhard Weinberg, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's author of Germany, Hitler, and World War II, and The Foreign Policy of Hitler's Germany. Good evening and welcome, Gerhard Weinberg.
Good to be with you. Good evening.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Gerhard Weinberg, I guess there's a lot we want to learn from you tonight, but I guess the first question is, did you sit down with a bowl of popcorn and the rest of America and watch the first part of the miniseries last night?
Yes, I watched without a bowl of popcorn.
And did you find anything edifying or offending, or how did you come away from the first bit?
Well, the part on the youth period was so preposterous that it confused rather than enlightened people. Section for the war, First World War years, made a certain amount of sense.
Showing Hitler in the trenches as a soldier in World War I.
Yes. And then the transition from that to speaking was not well handled, but the role of enthusing people in evening meetings in beer cellars in Munich was on the whole reasonable, and while the role of his friend Hans Stengel was somewhat exaggerated, it was not made up. He was important in the early years. There then came the coup attempt of 1923.
That left Hitler ultimately in prison.
That left Hitler in prison. And while parts of that made sense, I don't think it was handled in such a fashion that the ordinary viewer who had not read extensively up on this could follow what was a very complicated series of events.
Gerhard Weinberg, we're going to stick with you through this hour, and we hope learn a lot about what happened during that period. Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in here before we come to the close of this section. Just an endlessly compelling story of a horrifying man and a horrifying rise to power.
Yes, and a story that has a moral for a two-party system. You know, we kick it around all the time, twiddly-dee and twiddly-dum, Republicrats, that's what Ralph Nader said in the last election. And yet Hitler came to power because there were five major parties splitting the vote. His high watermark in July of 1932, his party was 37% of the vote. That is to say, 60%+ of the people were against him. But because of the way the votes were divided, his party came out narrowly ahead. That can't happen with the two-party system. And when people keep talking about, changing it, for example, with proportional representation, which sounds like a good idea, but, of course, part of it leads to the third-party scenario. And we've had that in this country. In 1936, Huey Long planned to run for the presidency on a third party to take enough votes away from Franklin Roosevelt to elect the Republican. The Republican wouldn't be able to cope with the Depression. And as Roosevelt said, Long plans to be a candidate of the Hitler type for the presidency. He was called the Führer of Louisiana. And not for nothing. He ran roughshod over the legislature. He threw out election results he didn't like. He used his National Guard to coerce political opponents. He was the real thing, and it nearly happened here.
Jack, we'll come back and look at more after a break. We're talking tonight about the rise of Adolf Hitler and how a democracy produced the Führer. You can join the conversation. How could a democracy, any democracy, open the way for this man, and does Hitler's rise point to a fundamental weakness in democracy, or was it unique to his time and place? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the rise of Adolf Hitler and how a democracy produced the Führer. Our guest is Gerhard Weinberg. He's joining us from Eflin, North Carolina. He's professor emeritus of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You can join the conversation as well. Is a multi-party system more vulnerable here? Does the Hitler story make you glad for a two-party system? And are there lessons we can draw today from what happened in Germany 70 years ago? Let's hear the real voice of Adolf Hitler. Here's a campaign speech from July 1932 where Hitler rails against the 30 political parties in Germany.
Die Gegner werfen uns Nationalsozialisten vor und mir insbesondere, dass wir intolerante, unverträgliche Menschen seien.
Our opponents accuse us National Socialists, and me in particular, of being intolerant and quarrelsome.
Und ein starer Politiker.
They say we don't want to work with other parties. They say the National Socialists are not German at all because they refuse to work with other political parties. So is it typically German to have 30 parties? I have to admit one thing. These gentlemen are quite right. We are intolerant. I have given myself one goal, to sweep these 30 political parties out of Germany. They mistake us for one of them. We have one aim, and we will follow it fanatically and ruthlessly to the grave.
Adolf Hitler, July 1932. Less than a year before he was to become Chancellor of Germany. We know what followed. Our guest tonight is Gerhard Weinberg. He's joining us from Eflin, North Carolina. He's author of Germany, Hitler, and World War II. Gerhard Weinberg, walk us through the ABCs, if you would, and we'll come back and look in more detail. But how do you describe, when you sit down at dinner, what brought Adolf Hitler to power? How did it happen?
There are, it seems to me, several critical factors. The growth of a political party which made clear to Germans, as in fact was included in the speech you just ran, that the model for Germany should be the Soviet Union and Italy, countries which had only one political party. And if that a political party which takes that orientation comes to be the largest in the country, that certainly tells you something about the attitude of a very large portion of the population to the concept of democratic government. That's one critical element.
That there was ambivalence about democracy itself.
There was very much so. Only in the first election after World War I, that of 1919, did the political parties which supported Republican democratic government gain a majority of the votes. Starting with the election of the next year already, 1920, the majority of Germans voted for political parties of the extreme right and the extreme left, which opposed the concept of a democratic small d democratic government.
So the democratic experiment itself was on a fairly weak footing in Germany. He wasn't up against a great democratic tradition.
He was not up against it at a time when the Germans, who resented and were shocked by having lost the Great War, simply would not adjust to this and therefore blamed everything that went wrong afterwards not on the leadership that had gotten them into this mess, but rather those who were struggling to lift Germany out of this mess.
There's a big perspective. Jack Beatty, let's just take that one up for beginners. Germany as a country not long experienced in democracy and wanting to kind of blame the democratic messengers who took over after the war.
Yes, and I'm sure the professor can enlighten us further, but it was especially unfortunate that not an Allied soldier stepped on German soil, I believe. I mean, it was a, you know, and so the issue was, wait a minute, we weren't defeated, we were stabbed in the back.
We were bamboozled into defeat.
Yes, yes, and it was, you know, civilian politicians who did this to us, and in all this too, you know, you're struck with the role of the Communist Party. Maybe the professor can talk about that. I mean, this was a party that was subject to foreign control, and its game was, you know, was not to win elections, but to sort of intensify, as the communists put it, the contradictions within German society by always taking votes away from the Social Democrats. And that, you know, that was at the behest of Moscow. And that created all kinds of problems for that Weimar Republic.
Gerhard Weinberg, how about the factor of the foreign hand in setting up the context for Hitler's rise?
Well, the foreign hand certainly does not help, but the opportunities and possibilities for them had been pretty much crushed by 1923. Thereafter, the Communist Party is there and siphoning off votes, to be sure, but putting the emphasis not on fighting the Nazis, but on fighting the Social Democrats, as was just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But the critical issue, it seems to me, was more a willingness, on the one hand, of enormous numbers of people to vote for and finance a political party that made clear there should be only one party and that Germany should go to war again, on the one hand, and a group of individuals who come to important positions in the early 1930s who imagine that they can somehow or other use this political party in order to return to some kind of pre-1914 system, and who completely failed to understand that this movement of the Nazis is going to push them aside just as much as it will push everybody else aside.
Gerhard Weinberg, I hear you saying here something that goes against, I think, some notions of Hitler's rise. I hear you saying that Germany, in some sense, got what it wanted, what it deserved, that the Nazi Party and Hitler did not beat and cheat and bully their way into power, but were invited in by a plurality of the German people.
Well, I'm not sure
that
I would say a plurality, but what had happened was that the president was influenced by a tiny clique of people, and that president had been elected by the German voters. And he is encouraged, ironically, at a time when the Nazi Party is declining in late 1932 and is losing the votes that it had gained in the summer of 32 election, and is having internal splits, and the German economy is reviving. It is under those circumstances that a very small number of individuals around the president, his favorite ex-chancellor von Papen, his son Oskar Hindenburg, the head of the presidential chancellery, a man by the name of Meissner, in effect talked the president into making Hitler chancellor, promising various things which they know they can't do, but just to bring the old man around. Now, at that time, the Nazi Party is, in spite of its recent losses in an election, the largest party in the country. It has more voters behind it than any other. And it has, over the preceding 12 years, made its position very clear. That is to say, these are not people who say one thing and then do something else.
They're talking about ethnic purity. They're talking about militarization.
They're talking about militarization. And very important, in my opinion, is that Hitler makes it very clear that revising the peace treaty of 1919, the Versailles Treaty, the desire of many in Germany to do that showed how stupid they were. He made it very clear that if he became chancellor, he would never go to war for what were, after all, very small bits of land that the Germans had snitched from their neighbors in preceding years.
So what would he do?
He would go not for border rectification, but for enormous space, eventually to control the globe.
And what about, Gerhard Weinberg, the whole role of intimidation in the rise of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party? Physical intimidation, rhetorical intimidation. How important was that?
I think it is important in specific situations, places, and times. And this was very deliberate. And in this regard, one has to say that Hitler himself was a very shrewd organizer, developer, and appropriator of symbols. The notion that in a modern mass society, as it had developed in the industrial world in the 20th century, having masses of people in uniform running through the streets, beating up on people, showing through mass rallies how many people were with you, you have not just what you might think of as direct intimidation and terror, but what I would call visual intimidation by constant marching of large formations through this town and then that town, sending people in trucks quite literally to small towns and then having a big marching column of uniformed people and so on.
We're big, we're fierce, we're on the move, and a kind of momentum play there. Gerhard Weinberg, stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. Edith is calling from De Pere, Wisconsin. Hi, Edith. You're on the air.
Yes. I don't know how many people about a year ago saw Bush on the television. He was pushing his agenda.
President Bush.
And he said, all of this would be a lot easier if I was a dictator. Those were his very words, and this disturbed me very much. I'm also disturbed by the...
I'm sure, but presumably he did not mean that anything like literal sense.
Well, there are other things about the whole situation that disturbed me. The tightness of control on information, the small group that are making decisions, the fact that the American public should know many things that are being held back by this small group. This disturbs me. The fact that they choreography every time he appears, playing the patriot card and all the nationalist kind of trappings and the way they position him for photographs and things, this disturbs me. The fact that this business of you're either for us or against us, they wrap themselves in the flag, and then if you criticize, you're unpatriotic. That disturbs me. And the thing that disturbs me probably most is that in the last presidential election, at the very most, 34% of the American public voted. And if you realize that half of those were Democrats, it means that Bush was put into power by 17% of the vote of people who voted.
But Edith, are you expressing here a really literal parallel with history, or are you just saying that you're uncomfortable with this administration?
I just think these are all signs that point to an anti-democratic regime, and I think this should disturb people in this country. It's not one thing. It's a whole lot of small things. And in a sense, what happened in Germany was a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, a little bit there. And by the time the people realized what had happened, they had them by the throat.
Edith, we've got your list, and I want to thank you for calling. Gerhard Weinberg, you've spent much of your life studying the rise of this man. You live in the same United States as Edith. Do these concerns resonate with you, or does it seem far afield from the Hitler that you know, the history that you know?
Well, I really don't think this is a very good time to discuss that. I happen to share a good many of those concerns, but I do not really believe that that's the critical issue in analyzing the subject of this evening's program. That is to say, the concept of a society which turns to an individual who wants to do away with all political parties, all civil liberties, destroy portions of the population and expand the country's control over other countries.
But here's a citizen, here's a citizen, Gerhard Weinberg, a fellow citizen, saying she has that concern. When you hear that, does it seem not in touch with the details of history, or does it seem a reasonable resonance to you, or are you saying that's not even a constructive line of thought? Does that mean we can't learn from this history?
Oh well, we can most certainly learn from this history. And the most important thing I believe we can learn is that the current cynicism, that people in politics don't believe what they say and don't intend to do what they say they intend to do, is a very dangerous illusion. People in Germany who heard Hitler, in some instances at least, said, well, he doesn't really mean that.
Yeah.
They have a German saying that the soup is never eaten as hot as it's cooked. Mm. Well, the fact of the matter is that most people in the political arena in Germany then, and other countries too, actually believe what they are saying and will try to do, whether they can do it or not is obviously dependent on lots of things, but will try to do what they say they are planning to do. And one of the extraordinary things is that an individual who in the Germany of the 20s and early 30s held up to the German public, we're not talking about secret documents here, we're talking about speech, that Italy and the Soviet Union as models for one-party states for Germany, okay?
And he meant it.
And he meant it, and voters by the millions voted for it. And there is a very important difference between German and American politics that most Americans aren't aware of. When our politicians come to speak somewhere, there is a major effort to get people to come hear them.
Mm-hmm.
In the Germany of the 1920s and early 30s, you paid to hear Hitler.
Wow.
And a large part of the financing of the Nazi Party came not just from dues paid by members and contributions, but came from thousands and tens of thousands of people who paid admission to hear him speak and would pay it again and again and again.
Paid to sit and listen. That's amazing. Jack Beatty and Gerhard Weinberg is saying, watch out for cynicism. There's a lesson to take from history. Politicians can mean exactly what they say.
Yes, and you know, the appeal of a Hitler, I guess, to the other side would be his dreadful sincerity. You can quite imagine voters saying, well, I mean, he at least speaks his heart. And we hear that a lot. We heard that, and I'm making no comparisons, about Barry Goldwater. He said absolutely ridiculous and frightening things, but people said, well, he's sincere.
Well, there you are. Sincere Men and the Reins of Power. We're talking tonight about the rise of Adolf Hitler and how a democracy produced the Führer. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the rise of Adolf Hitler and how a democracy produced the Führer. You can join the conversation. Are there lessons we can draw today from what happened in Germany 70 years ago? Is democracy eternally vulnerable to this kind of tragic lapse? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I want to hear a bit more of Adolf Hitler in his own voice, not the voice of a miniseries. Here is Adolf Hitler, January 30th, 1933, the night he became Chancellor of Germany, speaking to his SA and SS troops.
SA and SS, Heil.
Die große Zeit ist jetzt angebrochen. Deutschland.
The great time has now begun. Germany is now awakened. We have one power in Germany. Now we must win over the German people. I know, my comrades, it must have been difficult at times when you were desiring change which didn't come. So time and time again, the appeal has to be made to continue the struggle. You mustn't act yourself. You must obey. You must give in. You must submit to this overwhelming need to obey.
Adolf Hitler, January 30, 1933, the night he became Chancellor of Germany, talking about the overwhelming need to obey. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Our guest is Gerhard Weinberg, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Mudalfa is calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Mudalfa. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I'm just trying to draw some similarities and differences because I lived through the experience of the dictatorship by Saddam Hussein.
In Iraq?
Yeah, I am from Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a couple shows by WBUR.
And what do you say to the comparison that has been made from the White House? Saddam Hussein is Hitler. Does it ring true to you?
No.
Why not?
The difference is so huge. Hitler did believe in his own lies. I mean, he was driven by madness of ideology and Nazi ideology. So he was trying to apply this, and whoever stand against it will be against the whole nation. And this is exactly the statement of, if you are not with me, you are against me. And Saddam Hussein was someone who driven driven by his own individual ambition and his own individual selfishness. This is why he was brutal against the majority of people, and he wasn't like represented a nation ambition to be powerful or to eliminate.
Now that's an interesting point, Rudolfo. You're saying Adolf Hitler came to bear a huge ambition, ultimately tragic and horrible for his nation, but Saddam Hussein was focused on himself, and so you don't see the parallel.
Yeah, and this is why I would say even the numbers of death are huge with, a German Nazi, but Saddam Hussein was more brutal than Hitler. Although I do see some similarity in the practice of it's kind of ideology dictatorship. There is a huge difference between ideology dictatorship and individual dictatorship.
Mudalfa, we've got it, and I thank you for your call. Gerhard Weinberg, let me put it to you. When you hear comparisons over the years, and the most recent ones in the last decade between Saddam Hussein and Adolf Hitler, do you say, well, this kind of comparison has just gone too far? Is there anything useful in this? Is it just a way to raise the specter of evil and old horror?
Well, I would agree rather with what the gentleman just said, mm-hmm. and that is, I don't think we get very far by throwing names and terms around mm-hmm. and disregarding major differences. That doesn't make one better than the other or one worse than the other. Mm. The fact is that we're dealing with very, very different kinds of people with very different kinds of ambitions. And it seems to me, at least, that we misunderstand both Hitler mm-hmm. and Saddam Hussein by, so to speak, painting them the same color. Let me just point out one very, very important issue here. Mm. Saddam Hussein came to power in a coup. Hitler did try a coup, but failed, and thereafter went the political route in 1928. By that time, he didn't do well at all. And, in fact, wrote a second book after he lost badly in that election mm-hmm. Secretly. And it will finally appear in an edition by me this fall.
What was that book about?
It's about foreign policy, because he thought he'd lost
right.
because of foreign policy views.
Mm-hmm.
So, I discovered this book 40-some years ago, but it's never appeared in a reliable English-language edition. It'll come out as Hitler's second book later this year. But that same year, 1928, and the two other political parties that would be critical here, the Nationalists and the Center Party, turned to very, very extreme right-wing people who were prepared to work with him. And in the next year, 29, when Germany was to be freed of occupation, and was to have its reparations issues settled, the opponents of the Republic were terrified that the German people would become accustomed to democracy and parliamentary government. So they launched a big campaign against this, and it's in that campaign that the right-wing parties enabled Hitler, providing money to his party, to build up their strength and to make their appeal and eventually rally an enormous number of Germans who, after they heard him or read his speeches in the newspapers, decided, hey, this man is for us. Now, there's nothing in Saddam Hussein's career that bears any resemblance to this.
In terms of using the political system to rise in that way.
Right. And furthermore, while it is entirely correct that Saddam Hussein tried to take over Kuwait and attacked Iran and was always happy to be at war with Israel and anybody else in the neighborhood, the personal power issue is the critical one here, as the gentleman just said. From Hitler's perspective, Germany was going to conquer additional territory in enormous areas, displace the local population, not rule them, but displace
them. Push them out.
With German settlers. Mm-hmm. Now, what would happen when the German settlers met on the other side of the round globe was something he never explained. But that was quite a way into the future, and he didn't expect to be around by then. But you have here, it seems to me, a worldwide demographic revolution intended, on the one hand, as the goal, okay? And that revolution starts in 33 as soon as he becomes chancellor. But it is one that has been previously advocated and preached for years on end to the German public.
That's a pretty a goal of astounding ambition. And, of course, he built the machine that made its try at it. Nancy's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm very interested in how women voted for Hitler in 1932 and 33. I wrote my dissertation a number of years ago looking at propaganda concerning women in Nazi Germany. One of the reasons I was interested was to discover why women would vote for such a misogynist.
And did you find that they did, Nancy?
Oh, yes, they did. Not as in large numbers as the men, but they did vote in large enough numbers to make me wonder what was going on. And what I discovered was that women were feeling extremely insecure because within two generations at the very most, people had moved from the farm, so to speak, to the city. And women, when they lived on the land, at least even if they had a drunken husband, could provide for themselves and their children by having a large garden.
Mm-hmm.
But when they lived in the city, they were much more dependent on their husband's income. And I think that this was generally true of the German people at that point in history, that they were very insecure after World War I, and that this insecurity led to the desire for a man, a great, strong man who would take control and who would make things right.
So you're pointing to this issue of insecurity, and especially coming down to the women's vote at that time.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
You're pointing to this issue of insecurity that all Germans were facing and saying maybe women were particularly sensitive on that front.
I think that that was true. But I think that what concerns me today is that we're in a different but similarly insecure period here in the United States with a different but similarly right-wing government, which is taking away our rights. And that gives me pause, and I would like to hear what Professor Weinberger has to say about that.
Nancy, thank you for your call. Gerhard Weinberg.
We want to remember that, of course, women voted in Germany for the first time after the First World War. At one time, it was believed by scholars that they voted, that in fact they provided the Nazis with their big margins. Recent research by the lady who just spoke and others has suggested that they voted for him in very substantial numbers, but not in the kind of overwhelming numbers that at one time were believed. Whether the issue there is one of insecurity or not is very, very difficult to say. After all, Germany was less devastated by World War One than the other belligerents. We tend to forget that one reason that at least many Germans were prepared to go to war again was that the World War One experience for Germany was that 99% of the physical damage was outside the country.
It wasn't fought on their soil.
It wasn't fought on their soil. A tiny piece in East Prussia, but that's about it. Now, under those circumstances, it does seem to me that there was less, let me phrase it that way, less resistance to the concept of another war in Germany by women, many of whom had lost brothers, husbands, fathers, sons, than elsewhere in Europe, where in addition to that loss in the family, there was, if you will, the visible
immediate destruction, trenches through the backyard.
The immediately visible part. I think in that regard, what we're talking about is a difference between Germany and France, Poland, Italy, the countries of Southeast Europe. In other words, women obviously had not done well by World War One, but they had done even worse.
Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in. Nancy raises two interesting words, security and insecurity, and Gerhard Weinberg raises yet another interesting thing, war without direct pain, or at least war that doesn't land in your own backyard. Security and insecurity. I mean, insecurity can lead to positive change as well, I suppose, but in this case not.
Yes, I mean, the context, after all, is the Great Depression. Talk about insecurity. I mean, people were, you know, mass unemployment. I'd be interested to hear what the professor says, but I find it hard to understand without that context how this could have happened. And as I say, even a radical like Huey Long, it was making him a plausible candidate in the United States.
Well,
and the same kind of phenomenon. But, you know, to go back to talk about that insecurity and then to go back to the other one that Edith raised, which is the insecurity of being, you know, our other wars had an end. The war on terror has no discernible end. Mm-hmm. That means that the kinds of controls that can be implemented now can last and last and last. And if there's another terrorist attack and another, we're going to have more Patriot Acts and more this. And that scenario of authoritarian democracy, if you will, creeping in through terrorism and through an endless war where, you know, at the end of World War One, all the controls were lifted because the war was over, there's going to be no lifting if this war just goes on into the future.
Gerhard Weinberg, we have half a minute left. It's cruel to ask a scholar in that length of time, but what in your mind should Americans take away as the most productive lesson from this awful rise to power?
I should be very, very, very careful in insisting on the maintenance of a more than one-party system in which individual rights and dissent possibilities are always respected and protected.
Let us keep that at the forefront of our minds. Gerhard Weinberg, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Gerhard Weinberg is author of Germany, Hitler, and World War II, and a two-volume series entitled The Foreign Policy of Hitler's Germany. He joined us from Eflin, North Carolina. He's at the emeritus professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Jack Beattie, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by